This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 111th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have back with me again, Marcus Rainham. Hi, Marcus.
Hey.
Marcus Rainham is the Chief Security Officer at Tenable Security. He's the inventor of both the proxy firewall and early advanced intrusion detection systems. He's also an excellent photographer, a marksman, and a closet romantic. After decades in computer security, Marcus remains one of the sanest voices in the field, which is always a pleasure. And Marcus lives in the hinterlands of Morrisdale, Pennsylvania, on a big giant property. So thanks for joining us today, Marcus.
Hey, thanks for outing me.
No problem. It's already on Wikipedia. So let's just dive right in. This firewall thing that you helped to invent years ago is still in widespread use. Is that good?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for any given us versus any given them, being able to divide us and them is a good idea. The current crop of firewalls, formerly known as next generation firewalls, now known as current generation firewalls, are basically taking advantage of gigantic amounts of free computing that's available, and they can do some amazing analysis. And so, you know, it's still a useful way of dividing things apart, absolutely. In fact, I think, you know, I run into people all the time who say, oh, the firewall is dead. And, you know, what I usually say to those guys is two words, DNS and ARP. And if they don't just shut up after that, I know I'm dealing with a newbie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the ARP attack stuff, I guess most people didn't live through. It was funny to see that resurface when Wi-Fi first came out.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so obvious. Oh, wow, we've got these two critical components of our infrastructure that basically are completely insecure if somebody's on the local network. Let's de-perimeterize. Woohoo!
So let's talk about perimeters. There used to be more perimeters years ago than there are now. Because we have much more distributed architectures, our applications are distributed, we have geographically, you know, distributed companies, multinational companies, and the notion of perimeter gets harder and harder to distinguish and use, I think.
Yeah, so what you're saying is security has gotten worse, I agree.
Well, it's certainly gotten harder if you only take a perimeter view, which I know that you don't.
No, I don't. But, I mean, it's gotten harder and it's gotten worse because people persist in doing really stupid things. They persist in fielding applications that literally do not understand how to separate our data from their data. And if you don't understand how to separate my network from your network, I don't have much of a network, do I?
Right.
I mean, and that's really the problem. I mean, the last 15 years of computer security have been an exercise in people believing that you can do something fundamentally dangerous with safety, and that's just dumb.
So do you think that the dissolution of the perimeter will continue on, so we should just not even factor that into our future thinking about how to do computer security?
No, I absolutely don't think that's going to happen. You know, the people who are talking about dissolving the perimeter, I think they're arguing for something that's basically extremely optimistic and very naive. I mean, you know as well as I do that the only way you could really de-perimeterize things is if you've got strong endpoint security. Well, how's that working out for you?
Right, right. So philosophically, we should have strong endpoint security, but it's not coming along.
If we had strong endpoint security and terrific application security, then we could de-perimeterize.
Right, right. So the short, long and short of it is we can't really afford to de-perimeterize, and the best of all possible worlds is not coming about anytime soon.
That's right. And you know, the thing that really drives me crazy about this issue is that there are people who basically say, oh, we're going to de-perimeterize and, you know, things will work out. That ignores a tremendous amount of history. De-perimeterizing just doesn't work. I'm not saying that we're going to continue to have firewalls that look like, you know, proxy firewalls circa 1989. Nowadays, what we've got is we've got firewalls that are, you know, doing application level stuff that's pretty cool, that are doing all kinds of meta analysis and that are pulling stuff out of layer 7 to a degree that most of the early generation of firewalls didn't do. This is all goodness, because now it means you've got the ability to install and implement tighter controls on your data and what's going on your network. Again, the problem is most people just actually don't want to do that. So they're irritated by the fact that you've got these tools that actually give them the ability to express and define a more effective policy, when really the secret fact is that they never wanted to express and define a policy at all. They've just been looking for an excuse to go, you know, wow, it's like somebody who's... This whole deparameterization thing is like somebody who's, you know, going from fad diet to fad diet to fad diet, looking for a way that they can eat all the Ben and Jerry's that they want and still lose weight. It doesn't work.
I like it. So you've probably given hundreds of talks in your career, maybe thousands. What do you think was your best talk that you've ever given?
It depends on whether you mean best in terms of kind of critical impact, or best in terms of intellectual content.
You decide.
Okay, well, you know, I did a talk actually a couple of weeks ago in Minneapolis at Secure 360, in which I tried to boil down basically all of the rationalization of all the ideas that I've learned on policy management and detection since I started in this industry. And, you know, the more I keep thinking about it, you know, you get different types of signatures and algorithms and stuff like this, and I realize that ultimately they just boil down to one particular type, plus, you know, a wide variety of different implementations. So I tried to describe that, and I think I did okay with it. There were several people in the room who got it, but, you know, ultimately, you know, we're still in a market where you run into people who are selling, you know, signatureless detection systems that, of course, are just full of signatures. Not that there's anything wrong with signatures at all, but...
They just don't know how they actually work.
Yeah, but I mean, seriously, if you're part of the marketing department for a startup, you actually should know how your product works before you go along and say, "I know, we're gonna market this product by lying about what it does."
So, I guess I can take from that answer, from a meta perspective, that you're always on the edge of what you're talking about, and your favorite talk is the one that you kind of gave last because it's crystallizing your current line of thinking.
Yeah, correct. I think we should all be moving, you know, moving evolutionary targets. We should always be challenging everything that we accept as our own received wisdom. I think when we get to the point where we decide that we've actually figured it all out and stop reassessing it, you know, we're making a horrible mistake. My talk about the one detection algorithm is something that evolved out of years of cheerful academic debate with my friend Ron Dilley. We've basically been going back and forth about this forever. We started with that there were three detection algorithms, and then he pointed out that two of them were a superset of one, and then I realized that actually they're all three parts of the same thing. So, you know, yeah, it's been fun.
Mm-hmm. So. Right, so keeping up on the edge, actually, I guess, can be enhanced when you have to give a talk, because then you're forced to express the ideas that are bubbling around in your brain.
Right, and ultimately, anytime you're trying to express an idea, what you have to do is you have to figure out what is the backfill information that I have to give my audience so that they're going to be able to understand what I'm saying, right? I mean, this isn't Catholicism. You can't simply say, "I'm the Pope, therefore this is correct." You have to say, here's a bunch of pieces of information, and they lead you in this particular direction as far as, you know, here's the thought that I'm trying to guide you into, which means you've got to sit down and you've got to really think about what are the most important intellectual touch points that I used in order to derive my opinion. And, you know, if you can't do that, then you have to step back and go, "Wow, how did I derive my opinion?" Because what you're really trying to do is get other people to re-derive your opinion on the fly. It's fun.
Right. Yep. And I also think that when you do that a lot, like even if you gave the same talk, say 20 times, though it wouldn't be exactly the same, you get these perspectives from the audience that sometimes surprise you. People will come up and they'll ask something that you think is at first is crazy, and then you say, oh, I see, they're looking at it this way. And that informs your future communication.
Right. And then there's always the slight potential, which, you know, fortunately hasn't happened to me very much, but you know, that you're standing up there and you do a talk about thus and such, and someone raises their hand and says, you know, well, what about blah? You know, it'd be like, you know, honestly, if I was doing a talk on deparameterization and how this is a great idea and we should do it, and someone raised their hand in the QA and said, but what about ARP and DNS? I'd say, oh, everybody just ignore everything I've been talking about and walk off the stage, because, I mean, you have to be able to constantly reassess yourself. One of my favorite stories in science is one Richard Feynman recounted about a physicist who had this particular theory, and someone came to essentially present some results that completely destroyed this guy's theory. And apparently the guy was terrified, because here's this extremely important physicist sitting in the audience listening to him as he tears this guy's life's work apart. And when the guy finally grinds to a halt, the senior scientist stands up, walks up on stage, shakes his hand and says, thank you so much for clearing that up. I've been really bothered by this issue my entire career. That is the kind of intellectual rigor and self-honesty that we need in this industry. Again, that's why I get so angry when I see somebody saying, you know, we have a signatureless intrusion detection system. I know there's only one of two things going on. Either they're deliberately lying to their customers, which I'm inclined not to think they're doing, or they're actually so clueless about what they're selling that they actually do believe what they're saying.
Right. Right. So sometimes it's hard not to become cynical when you're faced with so-called progress in the field. Do you think we're making forward progress or not?
I don't think we're making forward progress at all, no. I think we're reinventing the same things over and over again at this point. And now what we've really come down to is reinventing the same things and coming up with new names for them. Which is, you know, I mean, it's like renaming the Titanic when it's halfway through sinking. Okay, that's good. It's now, you know, it's now the Royal Line Dreadnought, right? I mean, it doesn't change anything if you just start shuffling the deck chairs around like that.
Do you remember that the article that you wrote on the six dumbest things in computer security?
Absolutely, and I left the really important ones out because
how would you adjust that list?
I would adjust the list in a couple of ways. One of them would be, instead of simply saying, you know, hacking's not cool, which was kind of taking a social-oriented attack towards the ultimate problem, which is a failure to understand test methodologies that demonstrates itself in the form of penetration testing. Instead of trying to approach that from a social perspective, I would have preferred to explain why penetration testing is not testing.
That's what I try to get to with the badnessometer idea.
Yeah, I like your badnessometer idea, but I think, you know, how do we attack this? I mean, we have to go after these bad ideas by saying, you know, you're not actually allowed to use the word test. You know, Lord Kelvin says you're not allowed to use the word test unless you actually understand the unit of measurement that this thing's going to return. And one of the options it doesn't return is your network is secure. Other one that, you know, I didn't even bother going into because, frankly, I was getting really depressed and I was running out of wine and I just didn't want to go into it. But
there's a strong correlation there.
Yeah. But, you know, the other one I wanted to mention is, you know, transitive trust is going to always be a critical property of computing security, and there's absolutely no way around it. At the time when I wrote that, which is, you know, quite a long time ago now that I realize, you know, we weren't seeing any really interesting transitive trust-based attacks against the community, so I just simply didn't want to go into that because I felt like I'd be, you know, running around going, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. But, you know, if I were to rephrase it now, what I would have basically said is there's this other entire class of problems that we've been able to ignore because the hackers simply aren't that good. And the reason the hackers aren't that good is because they don't have to be. which is an incredibly depressing way of putting it, but that's kind of where I would have gone.
So, well, there are always going to be people that are breaking our systems in new ways once we figure out the old ways or stop the old obvious ways. And I agree with you that transitive trust is kind of the next generation of stuff that not many people have yet thought about. Some have. You know, the notion of trust enclave seems to come after secure design, which we're still flirting with.
Right. Figuring out your trust visualization, you know, would be a really fascinating thing. And there have been times in my career that I thought, wow, it'd be kind of cool to build a visualization tool that would allow you to establish some kind of a picture of what your trust relationships are, so that you could go to this thing and you could say, hey, if this particular business partner got penetrated, what would that mean to me? Then the problem is that that tool, if such a thing existed, would be way far ahead of what anybody actually needs, because the answer is, if any of our partners were penetrated to any significant deal, we're completely penetrated.
Well, you know, I think the other problem would be that it would become a fully connected graph very quickly. I mean, you'd end up with what happened when we started doing taint propagation and data analysis long, long ago, and you drip in the red data, and oops, everything turns red just instantaneously.
Right, which basically shows you a tremendous amount about network design, security design, application design, blah, blah, blah. Wait a minute. Aren't you the guy a couple of seconds ago who was asking me whether we're going to still need perimeters? As long as our model of computer security is, if you get one drop of peanut butter in the chocolate, that it all goes red, then, you know, yeah, we're still going to need perimeters, because that means we're actually still designing to the idea that we have a perimeter, whether the perimeter is your software, your data, or your network.
I think that's the right way of putting it. We're still designing as if there were a perimeter, or there has to be a perimeter. And maybe we have to. Maybe we have to.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I know you do this too, but since this is my opportunity to preach, I'm going to take it. You know, my entire life has been a process of trying to take a whole bunch of thoughts that don't really make a huge amount of sense for me, and then turning them into something that does make sense, and then I go, aha, if I can factor these things out and rationalize them, then I can understand the root cause, and then I can start trying to figure that out. And so, you know, every time I start thinking about this stuff at a really deep level, I come to this realization, which I will now share with you for the first time. Humans just aren't very good at things.
I think we knew that. Some of us knew
that. I know, but, you know, I mean, I just, you know, there's my TED Talk.
That's going to be a popular one for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is one of the things I think is, you know, really funny, and you know, it's totally relevant to what we're talking about here. You know, you keep seeing these mindsets, which I think are really laudable, where people are saying we're going to do this incredibly optimistic thing, but it completely flies in the face of human intellectual history, which is generally, you know, a massive sequence of failures, you know.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's pull this out of philosophy land and down to software land, right? So, you know, I harp on the importance of software security and building things properly and so on. Do you think we're making any progress in realizing that we need to build stuff differently than we have been? Or is that just fundamentally tied to, you know, this kludge that we've been evolving?
Honestly, I mean, I don't want to say your whole life's work has been wasted. You know, the folks who've been yelling about software security are great, and you've managed to make some important converts in some crucial places. And I mean, you know, you've managed to get the rudder on the Titanic turned in a good direction.
I think the rudder aims down in the Titanic.
Well, eventually it winds up aiming down. Yeah, that's the problem. But I keep going back in my mind to that amazing day in 1995. I was in a data center in Texas at Sterling Software with my friend Kent Landfield when Netscape went public, and yep. We saw that stock just go through the roof on that one day. And one of the things I remember thinking was that this is the age of the permanent beta test. We're actually never good. What we just saw is that if you write crap and throw it over the fence, you can make all the dollars, and there's never going to be an economic incentive ever again for writing good software.
Right. I think there's a lot of truth to that. Although we may be waking up from the long bender for some aspects of the world. You know, if you think about the notion that there are critical pieces of infrastructure that need to be built in a different way, and we can't rely on kludgy engineering for nuclear power plants, for example, because that creates a 30,000-year problem, then that sort of starts to wake you up.
What kind of idiot would use VLANs to separate the in-flight internet access from the engine control system? Something like that would never happen.
Okay, I give up.
I'm not saying give up. It's just, it's not even one step forward, two steps back. It's kind of we're doing this incredibly bizarre staggering around that's not even as directed as one step forward, two steps back. We're nonlinear.
So let's talk about marketing, speaking of nonlinear. So I've always been jealous of your sort of, what would you say, incredibly creative marketing prowess. You know, some of the stuff you've come up with is hilarious, like the calendar, the security calendar, and the tickets that you were writing way back in the NFR days. So where do these crazy ideas come from?
Okay, so I don't really know when I started with it, but I've always been a huge fan of surrealism. I feel like there's a little Salvador Dali engine running in my brain the whole time that's taking everything that I see, and it's trying to figure out, well, what can I add to that to come up with something extremely weird?
Yeah, the crazy angle. What's the crazy edge on this?
Yeah, what's the crazy angle here? I really want to be careful to choose my words so I don't sound like I'm patting myself on the back, but I mean, there are people who do so much of a great job of this, and we call them comedians, right? I mean, I got to figure that Louis C.K.'s brain has that little Salvador Dali engine, except it's fueled by meth. Right, or something. Did I just say he's a meth head? No. I mean, it's fueled by rocket fuel or something like that, right?
Right.
And those are the people who become comedians. So what you're doing is you're basically doing social commentary. And if you look at all the marketing stuff that I've done, it's all social commentary about what's ultimately dysfunction in the computer security world. So really all I'm doing is just taking a fraction of the goofy stuff that I see in my day-to-day life and trying to figure out how can I make this palatable and slightly amusing. Call me Pagliacci, if you will.
Yeah, and the humor is important to you, I think. That edge. It's not just absurdity, but it's also absurdity that makes you giggle.
It is. And well, so the whole thing there is, part of a realization that I once had, that happened around about the time that I started NFR and I started doing all that kind of weird marketing. I remember I was looking in my wardrobe and I was getting ready to put on a t-shirt. This was back, when I worked at TIS, and my wardrobe was filled with all these ugly t-shirts from all these vendors, and the only thing they had on them that was even remotely interesting was a logo. And I thought, why do I care about wearing somebody else's logo? And then I had the idea that our marketing t-shirt should be a t-shirt that somebody actually wants to wear for its own sake. Hey,
right.
What an idea, right?
Right.
And then you put your marketing stuff below the level where it tucks into the person's pants. And and that, if you remember, like, the security flow chart t-shirts and the internet police t-shirts and all those
yep.
kinds of things from back in the NFR day, the corporate marker was all kind of stealthed, And I knew that I was onto something when I was at Usenix, and I saw some guy pulling his T-shirt out of his pants so that he could answer the person who'd said, "Where'd you get that cool?"
Oh, all right. Let's go. Let's talk about hackers for a bit. So, at the top of the show, you said maybe that when you were doing the six dumbest things work, you took the wrong angle on that. So, do you give any quarter to hackers now? You know, to the idea of breaking stuff? Isn't talking honestly about an attack something essential?
Yeah, that's something that's absolutely essential. I think that in that situation, you have a rather weird crossover, right? So if you want to be a reformed hacker or whatever, what you're basically saying is, I'm a criminal who has learned how to act like a security consultant. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, why don't you just act like a security consultant all along?
The whole time, right.
The whole time.
Well, you know, some of us are like that, but we get less press.
We get less press, and we've got way shorter criminal records, you know. So Kevin Mitnick, you're a smart guy, and you've demonstrated that you can do basic flaw detection if you're stubborn enough. You know, why didn't you start off as a system designer? You wouldn't have spent so much taxpayer money getting arrested by the feds and incarcerated. And it probably wasn't great for you either. But just speaking as a taxpayer, I don't see any benefit to that. You know, so what we really need to do again is look at the situation and ask ourselves: is this the correct set of incentives? And I do know some really good pen testers, and the good pen testers, you know this as well as I do. I mean, arguably, you're kind of in that business, right? I mean, the good ones are the guys who say, "Sure, we analyzed your stuff, and we found these plot problems, but these problems are part of, you know, insert root cause analysis here, and here's a meta solution that will allow you to fix all that kind of stuff." That's very different. That's acting like a security consultant. That's very different from what the hacker does. What the hacker does is he finds one way in and then exploits it.
I think that's right, but I also think that in some sense you have to be able to think like that when you're designing even. So I don't think you can test your way into security either. Although we can't just abandon the testing idea. But we do need to figure out how to think through terrible scenarios while we're designing a system so we can avoid them.
Well, that's straight out of Sun Tzu, right? I mean, you need to understand attack and defense at a meta level. And in fact, once you understand it at a meta level and you study it at a meta level, then the details become indistinct. They're literally not necessary. And that's a very, very important process. I mean, I don't like advocating military analogies applied to computer security because I think that they don't really map very well. But you never heard of a situation of someone in the Middle Ages who said, "Hey, let's build a castle and we'll just put the walls any old which place and we'll move them around later when we discover where the flaws are." I mean, you have to think about this stuff as part of your overall strategic design. And I think that's why the whole Netscape IPO for me was such a horrific disaster, because it meant that the strategic design for software didn't even have "it should be good and reliable" on the table. The strategic design was "it should be incredibly marketable with a gigantic user base." And then you get, mm-hmm. The results speak for themselves.
Yep. So let's, who's influenced your career the most? Stick to humans.
Bill Cheswick has been a tremendous influence, kind of on the level of thinking about some of the firewalls, Belevin, Dorothy Denning. On the intellectual front, if I want to think on from the perspective of kind of professional career building, you know, absolutely hands down, one of the greatest people that you could possibly ever work for in your career would be Fred Avolio, who, you know, I worked for Fred when I was at Digital, which was a very formative period of my life. And Fred, you know, gave me all kinds of wonderful advice in such a down low way that you didn't really realize he was teaching you, which was amazing. And then I continued to work for him when I was at TIS, and just a great person. from a standpoint of bringing people along. You need kind of all these different sources at different levels, and each of them throws something different into the pot.
Mm-hmm. So in the last left field question, so what is your favorite power tool for use in home repair and improvement?
In home repair, probably a cordless screwdriver. But if I was to actually figure out which one of my power tools I spend the most time, it's probably my table saw.
That doesn't make it the favorite. I mean, that just makes it the most used.
Yeah, well, a cordless screwdriver is certainly, it's kind of one of the, you know, why have I been twisting screws for so long? That's really nice. And, you know, it can strip a screw out in no time flat.
I totally agree. You know, I have one sort of major power tool here at the beach house, and it is a cordless screwdriver. It's absolutely essential.
I know a guy who does fine art carpentry with a Sawzall. I mean, and this is kind of relevant to the whole computer security thing. I think what happens is you have to learn, you know, with any craft, you have to learn your tools. You have to understand what the strengths and weaknesses of all of those different tools are, and then as part of your meta analysis about, you know, what the heck is it that I'm actually trying to do, then you fit the tools in. If you do it the other way around, which is what I'm afraid a lot of people do, is they say, well, what tools do I have? Oh, well, I have a Sawzall, therefore I'm going to go secure my network with it. It all flows from having an understanding of your strategy and working backwards and downwards from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you ready for the reveal? So, Marcus, you were the guest on Silver Bullet Episode 3, which was exactly 9 years ago, 108 months. And I ask you the exact same questions. So now we get to go back and compare the answers from 9 years ago to now and see how they are the same.
What a dirty, brilliant trick.
It's going to be fun, but I'm not doing it until I'm back in the office.
Well, obviously, my brain is melting down right now as I'm trying to remember everything that I might have said back then, but all I can say now is that whatever I said 9 years ago, I believed it 9 years
ago. You know, I think you're a pretty consistent guy, Marcus, when it comes right down to it. Your philosophy's always been consistent.
Well, if I do guarantee you that if there's anything that I'm saying that's really fundamentally different, I could explain why.
I'm sure, of course, because of the evolution of ideas. I totally agree. Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Always a pleasure.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE Security and Privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to the Oakland Conference. The issue features our interview with Whit Diffie. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.